Okay, good morning, Professor Eisenman. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, the theme of our discussion will be the development of replica symmetry breaking in physics. But to get to that, which roughly covers from 1975 to 1995, but to get to that, I have a few preliminary questions, if you allow us. And the first one is, how did you first get interested in physics and then to pursue research in mathematical physics?
I see. Well, that's going really way back. So first, thank you for the invitation. So I define myself as a mathematical physicist, and what attracted me to that is, well, I enjoy mathematics, but it really talks to me when I see a combination of lucid arguments, which mathematics is capable of providing, which can be interpreted or project on interesting physics or other sciences, have some other implications. So for me, a theorem in mathematics is particularly delightful if it translates into some observation about physics or nature or other. Nowadays, it's even information theory, which I guess you may discuss whether it's part of nature or not, but it's beyond mathematics. And yet I still like even there to see the formulation in terms of mathematical terms. So that I, in terms of my career, I always insisted on having a joint appointment, in a way expose myself to pressure from both directions. As you know, these are somewhat different cultures. Mm-hmm. In physics, what counts is discovery of interesting phenomena. And it prizes exploration and discovery, making connections. It's okay if you fail, if you make a mistake, not fail, excuse me, this segment should be chopped off. So in physics, it's okay if you make a mistake. I mean, Columbus is celebrated even though he did not find the way to India, but he found something worthy, or at least from the perspective of people who sent him, or humanity. Actually cut this out because there are other aspects to this which I don't want to get into. But in any case, coming back to physics. In physics, what is appreciated is discovery. And it's understood that there will be errors along the way and they are tolerated. And one remembers not the errors, but the achievements. In mathematics, there is a bit less of tolerance of that, but more emphasis on understanding the structure involved. And I like the combination of the two. So having joint appointment kind of exposes you to pressure and criticism from different directions, and I find this healthy for me. And that's the environment I have been since my studies and then early appointments.
So I mean, as you're mentioning your studies, you did your undergraduate degree at Hebrew U, and then you moved to the US to do your PhD. What drew you or what drove you to move to the US for that?
Let me go back to the Hebrew University. What really ignited my interest in physics at the university was when we got to learn, excuse me, there is a phone which would interfere. Just a moment. Are we okay sound wise?
Yes, yeah. Perfect.
Okay, so again, this is a segment which I hope would be snipped out. So what ignited me to my interest in physics was when it came to analytical mechanics. And I was really struck by the fact that the same physics that we studied in high school, Newtonian mechanics and so forth, can actually be presented from a very different perspective as a result of variational principles. In Newtonian mechanics, there are forces, things happen because of forced acceleration, all that. And all of that is consistent with a totally different perspective of variational principles, which in terms of the mental framework on what's physical world about, how does it work, suggests a very different point of view. And then in quantum mechanics, it's even going further beyond that. Trajectories are not only those which optimize the action or for which the action is stationary, but anything can go. And yet all these theories are consistent in some sense with each other, at least in certain limits. So I find it fascinating. And after the undergraduate studies at the Hebrew University, it was clear that I would like to engage in mathematical physics. And I was particularly intrigued by foundations of quantum mechanics. At that point, there was a group in the US at the Belfer Graduate School of Science, which was associated with the Yeshiva University, which included people who really dug deeply into that. Among them was David Finkelstein. There was also, it was a strange institution. The history of that was, well, there's a Yeshiva University, which essentially was a college which gave students exposure to both the Jewish traditional scholarship and science, or beyond science, just college education. And not many realize, but the Albert Einstein School of Medicine in New York is actually affiliated with that, to this college. So I think it was in perhaps late 60s that somebody had the idea that if you can have such a school of medicine, why not also school of science? And that gave rise to the Belfer Graduate School of Science. It started by forming a collection of interesting individuals. Dyson spent a year lecturing there. Elliot Leeb passed through for a year or more. Let's see, among the permanent people who were there when I arrived was Aharonov. We had, let's see, there were people who really dug deeply into the question of what's quantum, how do we relate to it? Among those was David Finkelstein, whose fixation was that quantum physics tells us that the world operates by somewhat different logic than the classical mechanics got us used to. And his hope was to start from quantum logic, be faithful to that, and construct the space-time, the very space-time out of that. These were high dreams, and they really captured my imagination. I started my graduate studies there. It took me about a year to realize that all this is very exciting, but somehow I could not bite into it sufficiently. And then I also started to appreciate other things in mathematical physics. And I started the research project under the guidance of Joel Leibovitz, who turned to be my mentor. In retrospect, I think that many of the ideas which were played with there, in particular by David Finkelstein, had depth to them. And in the hands of people with greater mathematical skill, like Alan Cohn, actually found an expression in what we now recognize, you know, the Alan Cohn's non-commutative geometry, in a way involves mathematical expression to the sort of things which, in some sense, the David Finkelstein project dreamed to achieve. So it was not useless or wrong, but you need a combination of this loose, ambitious thinking with mathematical ability. Well, in Joel Leibovitz's office at that time, I found Joel Leibovitz's office was sort of like a train station through which were passing interesting people. David Ruel would pass by, and Oscar Lanford, and the classes essentially consisted of free discussions and occasionally a high-powered physicist would mathematician would pass by, and Joel would say, you know, David, tell us about Asano contractions, or Oscar Lanford, tell us about Boltzmann equation. So that was the education which I got. It was a bit like studying, getting for PhD at the Institute for Advanced Study. There are kind of no solidly organized courses, but if you can, if you're sufficiently open-minded and can swim a bit on your own, you get very interesting stuff happening around you. Field theory was taught by the Susskind, Eleni Susskind, who is now at Stanford. Shortly after I got my degree, actually the school was dissolved, or at least set back. The program, the PhD program, was stopped. What happened was that with the termination of the Vietnam War, there was a reorientation of national effort, funds were redirected. Also at the school, there were some hesitations about this program. So the Belfort Graduate School continued, but most of its faculty kind of scattered. In any case, by that time, I had a PhD. Eventually, Joe Leibovitz came to Rutgers. I got, as my first postdoc appointment, visiting membership at Courant Institute, where to some extent I completed some of my education, and then also a postdoctoral appointment with Elliot Lieb at Princeton University, where I found another very active, fertile ground. I came as a postdoc to Princeton, and Barry Simon, who was not far from my age, but at that point was already tenured professor or associate professor, was giving daily lectures on the books which he was writing about mathematical physics. So I managed to catch up with formal education in these two postdoctoral appointments. And I also benefited from mentorship by Elliot Lieb. So I think it was somewhat chaotic, but it was a great introduction to science, very varied in a way.
Could you describe a bit how you were selecting problems as a postdoc and as a junior faculty?
Some of it was through a combination of things which intrigued me, which I found intriguing, but that of course was also a function of what I was exposed to. So some of that was discussions around and recognition of some problems as interesting and challenging, and you hear what's going on, you have your own thought, and you go and start coming up with ideas, and most of them are wrong, but you keep thinking. And I like to take a problem and turn it over in my mind, think about it for a while before there is a breakthrough. I do not enjoy working in a field in which there's a very busy crowd. For example, when I got my PhD, the message for students of physics was that high energy is where interesting things happen, and the structure of elementary particles, somehow the best should go there. I felt that it was too crowded for me, so I kind of pulled away from that. Also, when I arrived at Princeton, at that time, the main call for mathematical physicists was related to the constructive field theory program. its architects presented the case, and it was generally accepted by both physicists and mathematicians, that there's a crisis in physics. We do not understand what's quantum field theory, how to think about that even. And the Haag and Whiteman program offered the direction, and it was a call to arms for all hands on board to make sense of constructive field theory, because there's a crisis in physics and it's up to us to rescue the situation. And again, I had the feeling that a lot of talent goes there and a lot of energy, and I had not find that sort of style of work appealing. But I did hear the challenge and some of the discussion. We had a regular, at Princeton, we had a regular weekly seminar. In addition, there was a weekly brown bag, which was a marvelous occasion. People would come in, I think it was Thursdays, noon, everybody with a brown bag with a sandwich. And the participants included Freeman Dyson, Elliot Lieb, Barry Simon, Jörg Fröhlich, who was there. I was there as just a postdoc, and starting, various other people passed by. It was very lively and very freewheeling discussion. People would share with others interesting ideas, observations, they'd be challenged. It was a very stimulating environment. So initially, the topics which I picked of interest for me were critical phenomena and critical behavior, structures of the easing, Gibbs states of the easing model, some detailed issues related to that. With time, the unexpected happened, and that is through the study of statistic mechanical questions, scaling limits of critical easing models and the like, I came to construct a proof that actually of a result which had implications for the constructive field theory program that culminated in the proof that that in four dimensions, which was the goal, the scaling limit of critical StatMech models, including the standard model for FIFO field theory, would actually be Gaussian. A colleague referred to this as a destructive field theory result. Another topic which I found very fascinating at that time is related to the general observation that, first of all, there are similarities between structurally different models, like percolation model and easing systems. The way you introduce them in class, they are very different, and yet they are deeply related. Nowadays, it's well understood that they form just two cases of the family of random cluster models. And in fact, there are relations between random cluster models to the point that what you learn about one can be used to deduce properties of other models. Existence of phase transition in any of those implies existence of phase transition in any other. Related to that is the theme which started to play great role in my thinking about topics that I was interested in, which is that critical phenomena are related to emergent stochastic geometric structures. For example, the formation of long-range order in easing-type models can be viewed as percolation of clusters, which are fully correlated, and it's nicely expressed in random cluster models. So there was a very joyful period in which the progress was made. The way I thought about the way the progress was made is climbing kind of a ladder with your two feet. So sometimes there would be a result which we understood about easing models, and you could ask yourself, is there any echo of that in the stochastic geometric model, say in percolation? You would find that, that would establish a new result for percolation models, but that would go beyond what was previously known for easing. So you'd ask, what about here? And there are things which are natural from one perspective and things which are natural from another. And it's like riding a bicycle, pushing on two pedals, half of the cycle, you advance with the right foot, half with the left, and one leads to the other. Eventually, this actually also extended to quantum systems, because what we now, a bit later, that's more recent work, what we now have many examples of is that there are some mathematical structures, like loop models, for example, which can be studied just as a mathematical ensemble of loop models, but they have projections with very, very different physics. There is a standard example of a three-dimensional object which projected on different directions may project onto a circle, a square, or a triangle. Mm-hmm. It's really, there is a mathematical entity, and it turns out that there are systems which are linked through a common mathematical scaffolding, and these systems include quantum spin chains, like the Heisenberg model and others, on quantum side, then Q-state Potts models, percolation, and so forth. There's a common core, mathematical core, whose projections can be classical or quantum, and you understand this best if you're aware of these different projections. So something like this is actually reflected in a paper which we wrote fairly recently with Hugo Dumenil-Copin and Simone Wartzel, linking quantum and classical models and providing new insight on the for example, on the fact that in Q-state Potts models, the phase transition for Q greater than 4 is discontinuous below that, and that is actually related to the dimerization. The mathematics of that is related to the mathematics behind the dimerization in certain well-studied family of quantum spin chains. In fact, another even earlier example is that when you look at the good old classical Ising model, to really understand it, say the two-dimensional case, where the two-dimensional case is solvable by, it was solved by,
Onsager?
The two-dimensional model which was solved by Onsager, when you look at the solution, there are actually quantum degrees of freedom. Kaufman has introduced, and what's the name of our friend? Kadanov actually put his finger on that. There are spin order degrees of freedom. So in a way, quantum world emerges from very classical model, the most classical Statnik model you have. So I find this interesting and intriguing and entertaining. So that's a long winding answer to some of your early questions. Perhaps you should go back to questions now.
So, I mean, just by curiosity, while you were at Princeton, did you get to know and interact much with Francesco Guerra, who was commonly involved in the Riemann?
Uh-huh. Good point. So when I arrived at Princeton, Francesco was there. I sort of saw him, but then he just left back for Italy, having left When I arrived at Princeton, Francesco was there. I remember seeing him in a seminar, a mathematical physics seminar, but he left shortly thereafter back to Italy. Having made a very important contribution to the constructive field theory program. Essentially, there was a period when results were derived through cluster expansions and other rather kind of hard analytical methods. And Francesco brought a new lamp onto that. Well, it's related also to the work of Nelson, but Francesco Guerra pointed out that if you think about this functional integral from the statistical mechanical perspective, suddenly you can see relations which provide the mathematically simpler methods for the proof of what you see, but also perspective, which goes deep and is very useful. I was quite amazed when years later, Francesco Guerra had a similar impact on the spin glass theory. Again, his results, his perspective came out of nowhere, it seemed, and suddenly got things moving. At least that's how it appeared from a distance.
So let's talk about your contribution to spin glasses then. I mean, when did you first hear about these models and family models and the ideas of replica symmetry breaking? And then what led you to work on formalizing certain aspects of these results?
So as far as I recall, and you may not trust my recollection on that, but I think that I first heard in depth about spin glass models from a series of lectures which David Ruel gave at Rutgers. I think it was around 1986. David was a frequent short-term visitor, and on such occasions he would present what's on his mind. And he actually gave a very intriguing presentation of the Parisi solution. And around that time, I discovered—I was informed of the subject. Around that time, presentation leads to questions and leads to challenges and answers. So during that time, we wrote jointly with Joel Leibowitz and David Ruel a short paper. There are a couple of aspects of the spin glass model which I found initially intriguing. One of which was this relation to random matrix systems, and the fact that whereas the spectrum of random matrices has the universality and so forth, which is not now, at that time was to some extent already well understood due to the works of Wigner, Dyson, and Mehta. When you modify this by looking at not at the Hilbert's regular Hilbert space in which the random matrix acts, but the spin models, the discretization which you produce makes this suddenly much harder problem in a way. For example, finding the ground state energy of the SK model in itself became a surprisingly difficult question. Eventually, it was understood that to determine that, you really have to make contact with the solution, essentially Parisi's solution of the model provided a tool to compute it. It's a surprisingly difficult way to get what for random matrix is a much easier problem. Then one of the questions which popped up immediately is there a phase transition at which you have what would be referred to as non-trivial overlap? What is it, replica symmetry? What in the replica jargon is referred to as replica symmetry breaking. Mm-hmm. So in that paper with Leibowitz and Ruel, we pointed out that the free energy, two things. First is that the free energy of the model at high temperatures can be, the distribution of that can be determined, and it's actually, there was a very strong result in the sense that it was identified up to the critical point, and it had only fluctuations of order one, even though we are talking about the free energy of the full system. And you can see also the phase transition occurring, so approaching as you come from the high temperature. So it's, and we also gave a proof of the existence of replica symmetry breaking at low enough temperature. Now, so that was the initial result we presented. It did not bite into the question of the full structure of the replica symmetry breaking at all. But that's to answer your question, that was the first. Then there was another thing which came, which I was amazed at in the presentation by David Ruel, which was the perspective offered by Derrida's REM and GREM models. So So the theme of David's lectures was essentially the Rida's REM and GREM models. And as you, both of you know very well, our friend Bernardo Rida repeatedly has demonstrated the talent for picking some doable calculation and then using this to shed light on something which goes much, much further. And he introduced the REM and GREM models initially as finite systems, which can be studied to some extent and shed light on what's going on. David Ruelle took the next step of actually formulating a system which captures the infinite volume limit of the REM and GREM models. And it was very intriguing, and I was introduced to the subject by those lectures. And that has also affected my perspective on the system. I can say much more about that, but that was the beginning of it. In a way, there are, let's put it this way, there were different layers of problems. One was determining the free energy and existence of phase transitions of the model. But for that, I think you, in this case, it's very important to understand the structure of the Gibbs states in finite systems under the SK interaction. From mathematical perspective, at least to the extent that I could see that, the technique which Parisi brought to the subject is absolutely remarkable, and it's amazing that it works, but it has been very hard to understand the magic there. And as a general comment about work of mathematical physicists, at least in my experience, the way we approach the problem and try to make sense of it is not peeking over the shoulder of the physicist who does it first, just to dot the I's and cross the T's, because that seldom works. And there is no much fun for us. And that's not appreciated by the originator of the work, because he feels that the mere fact that people dot the I's and check the T's, they suggest that he did not know or she did not know what they were doing. But the way progress occurs is that you take the challenge, you take the question, try to understand it in ways which are amenable to mathematical ideas and approaches. So I think that the replica symmetry calculations and the validity of the Parisi calculation can be understood sort of ipso facto once you understand the structure of the Gibbs measures, finite system, but very large system Gibbs measures. And a picture which explains it very well, I think, is the ansatz that the Gibbs state has a decomposition into what may be regarded as pre-pure states. For regular finite range interaction, the theory of infinite volume Gibbs states is well understood, and it lends itself to the notion of extremal Gibbs states. This is more complicated in finite systems, and part of the challenge is to make sense of that, but that's more or less manageable. You kind of see where the ideas may be put together. It's less clean, but conceptually there is an appealing picture there. But the question is, what's the structure of these states? And to my mind, these continuum models, which Ruelle identified as the limit of the Rida's GREM and REM, are fascinating. And actually, to clarify that, I spent some time with collaborators. We had there were two papers in which this was, in which we tried to express this. One was eventually published with Anastasia Ruzmaikina, the other one with Louis-Pierre Arguin. One way to think about it is, let's see, let me restart the picture, but perhaps I should pause here because I'm now about to glide into this detailed discussion of the Spinglass model and Parisi solution and so forth. More general
questions. We can come back to that. I wanted to ask questions more immediately in the aftermath of your first work. If you I saw that you wrote an NSF grant right after that paper where you said you wanted to keep on working on spin glasses and in the following 3 years. And I don't think you did at that point, or at least not in the publication record. Could you tell us what happened or why?
Can you remind me of the year?
This would be 1989 to 1992. That was the grant that mentioned spin glass.
I see. 1989 and 92. Yes, that's right. So just a second, let me remind myself of that. Yes. Okay. All right. So 1989. At that point, I was at Courant Institute and about to make a transition to Princeton University. Now, in addition to the spin glass models, I've been interested in various other topics at that point. And in particular, my attention was drawn to Anderson localization and delocalization. Just a word about that. When Phil Anderson introduced the ideas of Anderson localization, there was a lot of resistance because in physics community, the feeling was that we understand periodic systems. And if you add a bit of randomness to the Schrödinger operator, well, perturbation theory should be able to take care of that. And it was a bit of a surprise, and eventually it was accepted and then proven mathematically, even before it was accepted by perhaps all that. In one dimension, any amount of homogeneous random disorder actually has a drastic effect of changing the spectrum from being absolutely continuous to pure point, Anderson localization. Nowadays, we kind of came about to the point where we actually understand much better the Anderson localization than the persistence of delocalization, which kind of turned the wheel. However, around that time, the proofs of Anderson local mathematical proofs of Anderson localizations were rather hefty mathematical physics using multiscale analysis of Froelich and Spencer and so forth. I was just intrigued by that. And in 1990, if I remember correctly, I received an invitation to spend a term at Caltech as the Fairchild Scholar. And I used this time to delve into these topics. And what came out of that was the fractional moment method, which enables you to understand Anderson localization in a very easy, simple way, and various other properties which were not within reach before. So somehow my energy was directed in this direction, and the results were fine. It was fun. I did continue to think about the spinglass models, and I did not publish, but I thought about that. I also talked about this, for example, on other occasions when I talked about this was on visits to ETH Zurich, where I would periodically visit in the summer. I was intrigued by this continuum Rehm and Gremm models in various ways. One is how to formulate them mathematically. I mean, David Ruel's work was fundamental, but there was still room for better mathematical grasp of that. And the other challenge, which I found fascinating, was that I think that these models capture some are of universal interest. Namely, if you have a situation in which there are, well, the simplest model I could think then for that was the Indy 500, or think of Tour de France. You have bikers, there is a crowd of competing particles or cyclists or cars. Day after day, they advance, they make some progress. But statistically, when you look at the distribution from the leading edge, somehow the distribution of the crowds, the probability of that is stationary in time. Of course, the crowd moves and progresses, but the point processes seen from the leading edge is stationary in time. This kind of stability, I thought, in a robust way, may be valid only for distributions of the type that Ruel was talking about. So I was trying to A, come up with a mathematical description of these models, B, prove that any system, any point process with sufficient structure and stability, or this stationarity relative to the moving leading edge, should be described by one of these models, and the order parameter for that is the Parisi order parameter, which is a function on the unit interval. So I was kind of trying to cook this in my mind, and the progress on that was slow, A, because it's I was slow on that, and B, because I was also having a lot of fun with Anderson localization and other topics. My presentation, whenever I was in Zurich, I kind of talked to the right people about it, Irving Bolthausen and Alan Sol-Schnittmann. And eventually, at least I had a positive effect of stirring their interest in the subject. And they wrote a beautiful mathematical work formulating this from probabilistic perspective. So it was not a totally wasted time. What they did was to actually present the probabilistic formulation of these models. And the other part of this project, in my mind, was to prove that any dynamical process, which is quasi-stationary in the sense that I indicated, should be given by one of those models. Where to avoid obvious degeneracies if it's quasi-stationary in a robust sense. Now, if you have this result, you can actually understand in a structural way where does Parisi solution come from. And I could say more about this later. But to answer your question, so in those years, I was more successful at making progress on other fronts, but I kept cooking those ideas in my head, and I tend to work slowly.
Were you following what other mathematical physicists were doing at that time, say Pasteur, Leonid Pasteur and Francisco Guerra, or, I mean, yes, at about those years?
My style in general is to be informed to some extent what people do with interest, but I was not very closely following that. I think that I of course had chances to meet the two, and I appreciate them, and I think that we are among friends there, and we exchanged some thoughts and observations, but I was not following very closely.
I see. So would it be fair to say that the mathematical community working, mathematical physics community working on spinning glasses was very atomized? At least in those years, so you were loosely aware of each other's work, but not deeply entangled.
That may be, yeah, I think that's true. Yes, yes.
Now, we could get back to the question that, a few of the questions that you've brought up yourself earlier. Right?
Let me comment that Yasha Sinai, I think at one point commented that physicists behave as communities of dogs and mathematicians as cats. And I'm somewhere in between. And that, I mean, we are animal lovers of all kinds, so it's not meant in any derogatory term, but in terms of
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So you've described a bit sort of how working on these problems have influenced your later work. Would you mind getting back to those questions at this stage?
Okay. So, as I say, one thing among the things which I like in the models that I work on are that they offer you a perspective, the perspective which is associated with this. And often, once you develop certain perspective, your imagination kind of flips from one system to another. So in one case, it was the emergence of stochastic geometric structures, and that's very fruitful in very different setups. Spin glasses, as you know very well, capture our imagination because the phase transition there is associated with the result of what happens when you have a huge, a vast collection of competing alternatives, and it's not a phase transition where long range order occurs into one phase, but rather you have really large collection of potential states which are very different from each other. And as the control parameters change, at low temperatures, you see states which result from this sort of competition. So that picture applies, and we understand very well, and the School of Parisi, Merzar, Virasoro, Ecole Normale, I think, centered groups, and not to detract from any other, I mean, Rome and so forth, physicists realized how exciting that is and how far-reaching it is. I remember hearing also from Nick Surlas implications of this for coding theory, for example. And talking with Mezar, you are aware of all sorts of other implications. I found this intriguing. From a mathematical perspective, I also was excited by the realization that this process, which I just talked about, would be of relevance for a variety of other situations and topics. So that has colored affected my interest and also colored my thinking about the spin glass models. So if I can say a word about the spin glass models, say the SK model from this perspective, I'm not sure that the last word was written on that, even though Parisi solution was proven in Talagrand's paper to be correct for the free energy, and there were subsequent works which showed that the overlap structure may actually be given under certain auxiliary assumptions by these REM and GREM models, or at least this hierarchical of this hierarchical structure. To express this, I would like to start with a more trivial case of classical mean field model, say the Curie-Weiss model of ferromagnetism. If you want to understand what's the magnetization in this model, you may observe, first of all, that it's a system in which, since all spins interact with each other roughly equally, or in that case, really equally, the world as it is seen from a perspective of one spin, so to say, or if you wish, the effect of adding a spin to the system, puts you in a situation where you are asking, what is the effect of this community of other spins on the spin which is added? And to understand that, you want to know something about what does the rest of the system do without that spin being there yet? How does this affect the spin? And then there is this marvelous self-consistency, which says that after the spin was absorbed, it actually behaves as any other spin in the system. So in case of the in the Curie-Weiss model, the relevant quantity to understand the state of the spin which is added is just the magnetization of the rest. Now, when you add the spin, it affects the magnetization very weakly. And it's rather easy to compute in this case what would be the conditional magnetization of the added spin. And then if you add to it the statement that this magnetization, after all, has to be the same as every other, all the other spins, you immediately end up with the equation which describes the magnetization as function of temperature. Now, in case of spin glass, if you approach it from this perspective, you see that the addition of a spin to the system, let's see. So first you ask yourself what can be expected of the rest of the system, of the bulk. It may be described by a state which is, to a good approximation, combination of a large host of other relatively pure states of very different magnetization profile, and each one contributing an amount to the partition function. The partition function is sum of these terms. The addition of a spin does two things. First, it slightly shifts the weight of each of these extremal states, its contribution to the partition function. So there's a small effect on that. It may also slightly affect the states themselves. That's essentially that may be well captured by the TAP equation, the Onsager term in that equation. But then once you do that, due to the permutations, so once you do that, essentially you end up with a system which should be very similar to what you started with. And there is also an absolutely remarkable fact that, after all, there is permutation invariance in a stochastic sense here, which led, I think Mezar explained it to me first time, I was really struck by that the overlap between two spins in a huge system is actually very well captured by the overlap of any finite segment of the DNA, so to say, due to permutation symmetry. So in short, the particle which you add eventually would behave like any other of those which were before. If you consider the dynamics, so coming back to this picture for the partition function as a sum of competing terms, under the cavity dynamics, which is the process in which you add a spin and thereby modify slightly the weights of the competing terms in the partition function, you end up with exactly with this Indy 500 type of evolution, where they're competing. Think of the free energies, these are points on a line and they are slightly shifted by amounts which are now no longer independent but have correlation structure which is affected by the overlap between the different pure states. And as I said, there are reasons to expect that any process which is the result of this sort of dynamics, at least generic in the generic case, would have the overlaps described by this hierarchical structure of Grimm. Okay, if that is so, then you can actually get an expression for the effect of the change on the free energy due to the addition of a single particle. It's some functional of this order parameter which describes the splitting of this hierarchy. And if that's the case, then it's very natural to expect that the free energy would be given by the variational principle, which leads to Parisi's variational principle. So that's kind of a brief sketch of how I think of the structure of the SK model and how perhaps it would one day be approachable.
So that's a program that could be pursued.
In my work, I try to strike a reasonable balance between the technical part, you know, how much effort goes on to very detailed technical estimates and calculation, and conceptual part. I do not like to exaggerate in either direction. So I think that this theme was picked up by people, and I see papers which are gravitating towards that that perspective on the spin glass problem. One more comment about mathematical physics. What comes to me, to my mind, this is this question of how technical would you like your work to be? And there are different schools of thought on that. In mathematical physics, as I was postdoc, I heard different expressions on the subject. So one extreme was, say, Paul Feuerbusch school, who was saying that mathematical physics is like medicine. If it's easy to swallow, it doesn't do you any good. Then the other extreme would be Barry Simon's observation that, well, you know, if the proof is very complicated, it means that you did not really understand what's going on. And I hear both, and I strive to come up with mathematically rigorous arguments, but arguments which do not stray too far into just myriads of technicalities. So I am thinking long-term about various problems, but I would write when I feel that I have something clear to say on the subject.
Reach that balance, yes.
Right.
Since a slightly different direction, right? Since the late 90s, you've been maintaining a list of open problems in mathematical physics, one of which concerns the finite dimensional spin glasses. So we've mainly talked about the SK model thus far, but how do you think this problem is in mathematical physics community? And do you have any opinion or intuition about this problem?
Remind me, please, finite dimensional means what?
So the Edwards Anderson model, for instance.
ZD. Yes. I see. Occasionally, I hear about progress being made there, but I think that we are still. Let me actually not answer this question, because I think that there is some recent work which I have to look into.
Okay.
I don't want to say anything which would not
address it correctly. So during your time at Rutgers, at Courant, or at Princeton, did you ever get to teach about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail?
Yeah, I made presentations on the topic of spin glass models. I did not try to replicate and explain the Parisi's original argument. I think that the works speak well for themselves. That's very well presented in this marvelous book by Parisi, Mezavi, Rasoro. But I did present my perspective and Ruel's Graham models and my perspective on the subject and the questions which it leads to. So that actually has engaged in particular Louis-Pierre Arguin, for example, who went on to write some interesting works on the subject from this perspective.
So in what context would these have been, and roughly what years are we talking about? Do you know?
I think that that may be around 2005, 6, 7, okay. Around that time. So as I said, I was trying to interest people in the mathematical physicists in the subject and mathematicians, and also around that time I talked to Bolthausen and Schnittmann, essentially presenting this as a topic which could use some mathematical lucidity, and there are some interesting questions there. And myself, I tried to do that, and there were these two works, Rozmaikina and Arguin, in which we tried to Well, when she presented the results about the special features of these models, of this Gram hierarchical distributions.
So we're nearing the end of the questions I've prepared, at least. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have overlooked or we have missed, or this problem more generally?
Well, what I want to say is that this this circle of observations, ideas, and lessons, actually, this is still a very active subject, including among mathematicians. And I was delighted to see the way it has affected the thinking of, Lenka Zdeborova, recently there was a talk at Princeton by Nikki San. Alan Sly are working on proving fascinating results about threshold phenomena in KSAT problems, which are of interest for computer scientists. All of that is inspired by the Spinglass perspective. So that's a very active field, I think, still, and it has affected the working of physicists, but also mathematicians on a host of other topics. It's a strength of a perspective, and the tools which this leads to.
Francesco, is there anything that you'd like to ask before I forget?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So the final question, have you kept notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have any plans to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I did not think of depositing correspondence in archives, no, but I may have some. Yes. It's an interesting idea.
I encourage you to consider it if ever one day when you have time. There's certainly some interest for the history and the fields themselves and the history of science, obviously.
So, interesting idea. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been very nice conversation. Very enlightening.
Thank you.